There was a time not long ago when most people said they got their news from one of three TV networks, and everybody in the country knew who this guy was.
Good evening. President Ford has proposed that the nation resolve its energy problems once and for all with the same sort of crash effort that produced the atomic bomb and landed man on the moon.
That's Walter Cronkite, of course, but news today is nothing like it was then. It doesn't just inform, it often entertains. We get our news in silos, and we may not know the person and the individuals or even the program that our best friends are receiving their news from. And the line between journalism and entertainment is less clear every day. So today we'll be talking with media experts about how entertainment and news have changed over the years and how they affect us. We're also going to meet two Durhamites who host their own entertainment news show on social media. And as a prelude to all of that, we thought we'd examine the way media that we consume affects our view of the world. Can the movies we watch, for instance, change the way we think about power and democracy? The answer is yes, according to at least one new study. It tested whether films we watch can affect our leanings on authoritarianism. Ben Taylor is an assistant professor of political science at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. He co-authored the study and joins us from partner station WHQR. Ben Taylor, welcome.
Hey, thank you. Well, I'm glad to be here.
It's good to have you. Tell us more about the premise of your study.
Well, my co-author and I, Jeff Glass at the University of Georgia, we're interested in the way that films can affect latent personality dispositions, and in our case, authoritarianism, and then the way that that might affect down-the-line political attitudes. And the reason this is important is because there's a great deal of work that looks at how media affect us and then the outcomes, political outcomes of that media consumption, and there's good work on authoritarianism, but there was nothing connecting the two. And our starting place was this idea of social learning theory, because when one enters into a political into a movie theater, you enter the willing suspension of disbelief, and there's a reason to believe, based on several psychological theories, that can have effects on the way you understand the world, at least having watched the film. And so we did an experiment where we randomly assigned people to watch three different films, 300, a film about Sparta and the Battle of Thermopylae. We had them watch V for Vendetta, which was a film about anti-authoritarians in this fictitious UK environment. And then we had them watch 21 Jump Street as a control group. And we found that, in fact, these films, 300 specifically, does activate authoritarianism. And then that then affects attitudes. For instance, authoritarians are less likely to support immigration. That we found that they were more likely to believe that military service is a requirement for citizenship. They thought the United States was better than other places. And these are important findings. And then with V for Vendetta, we found that actually that decreases authoritarianism. And so that, again, has an impact. And so we think there's more work to be done here, but we thought this was a good place to start.
Well, I want to give us a sense of what it is they're watching. These are kind of both action films, not the control film, right? So
right.
Let's look at 300. I'm going to take a little piece of the trailer and give you a sense of the kind of feel that you might have had for the 90 minutes that you watched this film.
Long I pondered my king's cryptic talk of victory. Time has proven him wise. For from free Greek to free Greek, the word was spread that bold Leonidas and his 300, so far from home, laid down their lives, not just for Sparta, but for all Greece and the promise this country holds.
All right, 300 soldiers lay down their lives and lay the groundwork for the rest of the cavalry to show up and defeat the enemy. And it is a powerful film, and it's about following the leader and giving up your life and sacrifice. Now let's listen to the trailer, at least a piece of it, from V. Let's listen.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people.
Gentlemen, I want this terrorist found, and I want him to understand what terror really means.
You have one chance. You must tell us the whereabouts of Codename V.
If our own government was responsible for the deaths of 100,000 people, you really want to know?
And that's a clip from V for Vendetta. I'm talking to Ben Taylor, a political science professor at UNC Wilmington, about his study that showed watching these films can actually affect how we feel about authoritarianism. So what did you do? What kinds of questions did you ask?
Well, there are a few famous scales one can use in these things, but we decided to use the Feldman and Stenner Social Conformity Autonomy scale, which is just a scale that asks people about how they feel about raising children. So should children be courteous? Should children follow directions without question? Things like this. And this scale has been robust over several decades of research. And what's important, though, is that authoritarianism has been shown to be on the increase in general, and there's not a lot that's gone into understanding why that might be. And so we thought that, if we can find these effects in these sort of very common places like entertainment films and entertainment media, then that might be one of the reasons that authoritarianism in general has been on the rise over time. And so the questions, there are other scales you can look at, like right-wing authoritarianism, but that one has more issues. It may be more closely correlated with conservatism. And so we stuck with the SCA scale.
All right. Well, I'm going to talk to you more about this, Ben Taylor, who's a political science scholar from the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. He co-authored a study on films and authoritarianism, and we will continue that conversation as we explore the changes in media, how we absorb it, how we produce it, and what effects it's having. And we're talking about that today on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Ben Taylor. He's a political scientist from the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, and he co-authored a study on films and authoritarianism, and he's speaking with us from partner station WHQR. And Ben, before the break, we were talking about the fact that you did this study really to test for the impact of films, and we showed one that showed this kind of patriotic courage following a single military leader into battle. The film is called 300 and then V for Vendetta, which shows, sort of basically vigilante violence against what is very seriously, at least according to the film, a very corrupt government and dangerous one. To talk more about the outcomes, what did you find?
Well, what we found was that subjects who were assigned to the 300 condition, and so we randomly assigned these subjects. So they did not know what they were getting into. They did not know. All they knew was they were going to see a film. These were college students, by the way. And when we assigned them, what we expected to find, was that 300 would activate authoritarianism and that V for Vendetta would decrease authoritarianism. And that's exactly what we found. And this is important because often when we think about authoritarianism, we think of it as a discrete. You either are authoritarian or not. And what we know from a good bit of the literature is that it's actually more of a continuous variable, which is to say that you can be authoritarian a little bit or more, and that it can be activated. Generally, authoritarianism is activated by threat, more of a generalized threat. And in this instance, we show that it can actually be activated through film or media consumption, which is a novel finding.
Right. And all of this is generated. I mean, if we think back certainly to the 1930s, we wonder how good, sane, normal, rational people who we assume the German people were could ever possibly elect a man like Adolf Hitler, given what he was saying. And then, of course, in any way condone the atrocity. So part of it is, and as you say, we've looked into some of the triggers that can force people into this fear that allows them to lose their minds, essentially, and elect the wrong guy, as Chancellor Hitler was. But what in this case, you're looking at the effects of media. So I guess the next question is, what are the lingering effects, or do the effects linger? What's the long-term effect? You talked to them, I assume, gave them this poll right after they saw the film.
That's right. That's correct. And that's a great question. And that really is one of the next steps in this research agenda that my co-author and I have. And the main question is, as you say, how long do these effects last? There is some good research, not looking at authoritarianism per se, but more on entertainment media and the effect on political attitudes, that there is some decay effect, but there is a period of time after having consumed media that your attitude changes that are the result of consuming media do stick around. And so that's the next step in this research. Right now, it's just an open empirical question that I can't answer, unfortunately.
Yeah, that.
But my sense.
Oh, go ahead. Tell us what you think.
But my sense would be that it would really depend on the nature of one's level of authoritarianism before entering that environment. And we didn't test for that either. This is a post-test only survey. So
a little nurture and a little nature, right?
Exactly.
Is part of this thing. And then, of course, the repeated effect. So you see 300 and then you see another film that's a little bit like it. And, whether or not this is the steady diet of this kind of media, obviously you'd want to look at an effect like that as well.
Exactly. That's totally correct. And we did test for if people enjoyed the film, and there were minimal minor effects there, which is to say that it didn't change the overall outcome. So, entertainment value is something else you have to consider. Do people think that this film is actually interesting?
Great stuff. Ben Taylor, thank you so much for talking with us.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me on.
Ben Taylor, a political science scholar from the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, and our thanks to partner station WHQR for helping us with that. So if you're watching a news program on TV today, good chance you're watching satire. Audiences tune into comedy shows like The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, and they want to hear things that traditional journalists really are not allowed to say. Joining me now is Jeffrey Baim. He's a professor in the department and the department chair for media and communications at Temple University, also an expert on the rise of satirical news. He authored the book From Cronkite to Colbert, The Evolution of Broadcast News. Jeffrey, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Frank. Great to be back with you. Thank you.
So when it comes to reporting facts, tell us about this. I mean, this is not something that hasn't been spoken about because the phenomenon's been with us for at least a decade, maybe more. But what do we know about this, the fact that that people are more and more are going to this kind of entertainment and that it is embracing, these entertainment platforms are embracing the role of what I would have called journalist?
So I think, you know, we can go back to the year shortly after September 11th, the terrorist attacks in 2001, when Jon Stewart and then a few years later Stephen Colbert really emerged on the national scene. There's nothing new about political satire per se, but what they really pioneered was a version of satire that addressed daily current events and offered both information and commentary. So it became a platform for exploring the day's events from a very different standpoint from what the nightly news with Walter Cronkite, which we heard briefly, always has tried to do. They offered a different form of voice and a different way of speaking about public affairs.
It's interesting because there certainly are antecedents. I mean, people used to just listen to The Tonight Show in the first 10 minutes. They wanted to hear the monologue because Johnny Carson invariably would bring up the headlines and make some jokes about something in the headlines. So it's not like comedians hadn't been taking current events as, you know, as a staple for their material, right?
I think that's right. But I think Johnny Carson also went to great lengths to try to avoid political controversy. You know, he might offer a little joke about something the president said. But even then, Carson, I think, really tried to be apolitical. There are some other examples. Dick Cavett back in the day who wanted to bring what he called the heavy furniture of public affairs onto late night TV. But even then, you know, think of Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update, which has been with us since the mid-1970s. But even then, that kind of poking fun at the character foibles of a president is very different from the kind of sustained interrogation of public policy that you see particularly now in the form of, let's say, John Oliver on HBO, who does 18 to 20 minute segments on obscure policy that might have real implications, something like you began the show with, gerrymandering, for example.
And is this does it tend to lean left? Is this mostly progressive politics reflected in the satire?
I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think that satire has long been a mode for progressive interaction with the world. But I think we also want to point out here that when we're thinking about the intersection of news and entertainment, that satire is one formation. Often from the conservative side, you have people like Sean Hannity or Glenn Beck or Rush Limbaugh who describe themselves largely as entertainers, and I think their audience find them quite entertaining. It's a very different mode of speech, but one that still seems to function somewhat similarly.
Well, you're right, and it's a in both cases, this is a kind of a theatrical performance of public policy, right? In either case, but one, the progressive side does tend to take the form of satire, and then as you talk about, Hannity and others are this kind of outrage, right? This kind of banging the fist on the table and the sort of the blood bursting from the forehead. Is that, can we make anything of that, that those are two forms that are fairly well known to us and very easily cited, but, you know, we can understand which side they're on?
Yeah, and they actually have emerged historically really at the same time. You know, there's some interest, there's a really profound broadening of the media environment that begins in the 1990s and continues on today, of course. And both sort of the popularity of Rush Limbaugh, the advent of Fox News, at the same time as the development of The Daily Show in the late 1990s and then, of course, through the 2000s. So you see them happening in lockstep. And they're sort of both responding to similar conditions or a similar sense of shortcoming from what we could call the mainstream media. Right, a sense that that kind of model of objective journalism just wasn't speaking to and for people in the way that maybe back in the 1970s when Walter Cronkite was considered the most trusted man in America, in a sense that he was speaking on behalf of and for the entire population, whereas now we live in a much more fragmented age. And I think people are looking for more narrow voices that might speak on behalf of their own inclinations and sense of identity.
And that's interesting. And of course, social media, digital media has made that possible for us to get to find our way into these silos, because we don't only have three channels to choose from. And so obviously Cronkite and company and Huntley and Brinkley had to be down the middle. They had a split of a third of the, you know, they had a third of the audience. So let's listen to the difference and kind of how it plays out. I mean, if we listen to now a clip of The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, here's what we're talking about.
Basically, the Trump campaign allowed a journalist to hang out with them for months. Right. Well, the Trump presidency, they allowed him in the White House and this guy just hung out and he was just in the room, apparently. And no one thought about it and they just carried on with their lives. And then now he's like, all right, so I wrote a book. And the people are like, wait, what? He's like, yeah, I wrote a book. And they're like, where did you write the book from? He's like, oh, I was in the room. And they're like, wait, is that why you were in the room? He's like, yeah, why do you think I was in the room? Like, we don't know. We just have people in the room. We don't know. And now there's a book that's coming out. And I mean, some of it seems salacious, don't get me wrong, but there are some parts of it where you go like, oh, I can see this happening. And now Steve Bannon came out, like in the book, he's made these statements and Trump has come out and slammed him. What I find interesting about Donald Trump is his go-to attack for any person that goes against him in his campaign is basically straight up, I don't know who this is. That's what he did to Steve Bannon's life. He's like, Steve Bannon didn't help me. I don't know him. He had a tiny role. He was your chief strategist in the White House.
All right, so Comedy on the Left, The Daily Show with Trevor Noah on Comedy Central, a channel, and certainly not with the kind of viewership that CBS News might have had. Now, here's on the right, Alex Jones, entertainment news host who's found a home in the digital era. Very definitely not satire. Let's listen to his style.
Just like the Bible says, it's basically an intergalactic invasion into this space through people. I'm telling you, it's what all the ancients said. It's what they warned of. It's what we're dealing with. They're demons. They're frickin' interdimensional invaders, okay? I'll just say it. Make fun of me all you want on CNN or wherever, but everyone already innately knows this. These people are not frickin' humans, okay? Hillary Clinton is a goddamn demon.
Alex Jones on the radio. He's got a show. It's obviously not satire. A clip of InfoWars with the host. I'm here with Jeffrey Baim, who's a political satire expert. So obviously very different styles, and they found their niche, right? And do we have any idea, you know, sort of what the impact is? Because, you know, to me, in some ways, both of these can be seen as kind of professional wrestling. I mean, both the satire. I mean, these was a comedian, for goodness sake, talking about public policy, and then what it is we just heard. How do people consume this? Do they understand? We talked about the system. Suspension of disbelief. Do people approach this, do you think, differently and understand the information they're hearing differently than they might have when we were watching the CBS Evening News?
That's an interesting question. I think that the previous guest thinking about latent dispositions is a really interesting way to think about this, right? Increasingly, there is less this singular notion of what the good citizen should be, and there's a real dispute in our society about information itself, hence the name of Alex Jones's program, Information War, that information has become a battleground itself. We are skeptical towards claims of facts. Walter Cronkite used to finish his newscast every day saying that's the way it is. And that's a remarkable claim of certainty. Increasingly, people have a sense that different people have different ways it is. And so I think folks who gravitate towards Alex Jones do so in part because he is funny. I think a lot of us listening to that clip right now, we're laughing maybe at or with, but it is entertaining. It is a form of emotional engagement. But different forms of emotional engagement, I think, are so important here because we never receive information, in fact, in a vacuum, right? There is no such thing as pure rationality and pure information. The news has always told stories. We speak of the top story. And narrative is a really important component here. Narrative is always a combination of information, of emotion, and of a moral framework to make sense of that information. So what you see now in this split between, say, The Daily Show and Alex Jones, but I would also say, you know, CBS News or The New York Times are different modes of storytelling, different kind of emotional valences and different moral standpoints.
So let's see what that's doing to the business. What I want to do now, Jeff, is bring into the conversation Laura Davis. She's a professor at the University of California School of Journalism, also a social media expert who went from interning at the Associated Press to helping outlets like the LA Times and BuzzFeed make the most of digital news. Laura, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about this, because you start your career really at one of the oldest journalism institutions around, AP, and then start to work with other institutions, first the LA Times and then BuzzFeed, which is a digital baby, to teach them and understand how to write and how to be a professional in this new age. What is it that changes for a journalist in this age?
I mean, so much has changed for a journalist in this era. But I think something journalists should look at the internet as opportunity and not as something that's a threat or something that is, you know, here to ruin journalism. It's opportunities for new audiences. It's opportunities to evolve storytelling. And I think that's great. And I've tried to, you know, impart that on, you know, places like the LA Times that, you know, was working through its digital and its mobile transition.
Does that mean you just tell the same stories and change platforms, or is there a new way of expressing yourself?
That's a great question. It's something that, you know, I deal with a lot as a professor here. I teach a native social media storytelling class, and something, you know, I talk about a lot is thinking, you know, really thinking natively to the platform, which is to say, don't just take print conventions or broadcast conventions and put them on the internet. Really think about what the medium of the internet is and what it provides, and think about telling a story there that's best fit for the myriad platforms that are available to you.
But what does that mean? Because it does mean, obviously, I might change my language, the way I attribute a story. I'm not going to put things in parentheses and say, you know, according to, and that sort of thing. But is that it? Is just a matter of style, or is the way we tell stories and make attribution and include attribution? Do we drop those things? We say that's just getting in the way? Or what changes, really, fundamentally?
I mean, absolutely not for the, you know, just to your example of dropping attribution. I mean, I actually go over with my students, you know, I just lectured in my first class of the semester yesterday, you know, doesn't mean you drop your standards. Don't turn in, you know, a tweet series that you would think isn't good enough to turn in when you're turning in a traditional written story. All those values and standards still hold. But it's more about changing the tone around those values and standards, the way they've traditionally been communicated. I teach really conversational writing, for example. And it's not that that convention hasn't come into other formats as well, but, you know, embracing the way people communicate and talk on the internet and not trying to stick to conventions that were developed for newspapers, which are fundamentally communicating in a different way. I worked a lot, for example, in the push alert space when I was at the LA Times and BuzzFeed. And if you think about, you know, where a push alert goes, it goes to your lock screen on your phone where people are texting you and you're getting, you know, notifications about, you know, Facebook updates from friends and family, right? So it's a really personal space. And so I actually have a slide for my students where, you know, I have I had my friend text me in, you know, the traditional sort of breaking news flash format that's not very conversational. It has breaking in all caps. And I say, you know, is this how you talk to your friends? And I make clear that it's not that we're going to use, you know, old texting conventions like using R, just the letter R in the place of A-R-E, and U, the letter U in the place of Y-O-U. You still write up to high journalistic standards, but you can do that in a more friendly and conversational way that fits better in the flow of how people, like I said, are communicating on the internet and are communicating on these platforms.
I actually talk to my friends like Alex Jones, but but for this show, I actually changed my style. Jeffrey Baim, let me ask you about credibility, though. You talked about the fact that one of the reasons people have moved to these silos and alternate forms is because they've lost some confidence in the media. And yet we think the vetting practices of traditional media had been pretty good, and we don't know about the rest of the world. Why do people trust these new forms more than those conventional forms, do you think?
Well, trust is a really critical issue of our times, right? There's a lot of tracking of decrease in trust in social institutions in general, in government, in universities, in journalism. Journalism, of course, has ticked back up a little bit since the Trump election, but trust in the news has fallen remarkably, except trust in those media outlets that one feels comfortable. If we think of media as an ecosystem, right, what is the media habitat that people feel the most comfortable in? Listening to this discussion of changing tone of news for the internet, I think we can also think about different configurations of audience, right? So Walter Cronkite assumed he was speaking to every single person in the country. And the L.A. Times assumes they're talking to every single person in L.A. But obviously, we're dividing the audience so much more narrowly now, and people are self-selecting into those media environments where they see themselves most fitting. And trust is a component of that. What kinds of people, what sort of approaches does one find most credible and most trustworthy?
Laura Davis, I've left you only 30 seconds for this, but do you have to do anything special in these new media forms to engender trust?
Yeah, something I'm really emphasizing with my students and elsewhere is that we should be showing our work more. We should be explaining more about the journalism process, you know, writing in an authoritative way and just, you know, hoping that people trust you is clearly not working anymore. So we should be explaining the journalism process more. The Washington Post is even starting a series dedicated to this. So I think that's a really good sign. And we're seeing more and more of it. And I'm a huge advocate for it.
I want to thank you both. Laura Davis, a USC Annenberg professor who helped bring print journalism into the digital age. Jeffrey Boehm is an expert from Temple University on political satire. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we're going to meet two Durham natives who use Facebook Live to tell news like people tell it in the streets. And we'll be live streaming on Facebook when they arrive. So stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. So what does the face of new media look like? Joining me in the studio are Kevin Thomas and Kareem Jarrett, better known as Kazi and Bishop Omega. Kazi's a rapper and owner of State of the Culture, which promotes local artists and events. Bishop is an event host for Beats and Bars, Art of the Cool Jazz Festival, and much, much more, and a stand-up comedian. And together they host Intelligently Ratchet, R-A-T-C-H-E-T, just in case you didn't hear that right, a live entertainment news show on the web that combines street smarts and book smarts. In fact, we're going to stream our conversation to Facebook Live right now, and you can see it on their page, Intelligently Ratchet. Welcome, Kazi and Bishop, to the show. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having us here, Frank.
All right, so tell us about this show and what's behind it.
Yeah, so we did the show. I'm one of the creators of the show, Intelligently Ratchet. Mm-hmm. The show came out of what we felt like was a void in media, in mainstream media and underground media for conversation about news, politics, issues concerning, just to be honest, our demographic and right. And outside of even just saying like African-American, I'm just saying the younger, mm-hmm. What some people would consider the hip hop generation, people that generally aren't engaged in politics, news, or what's going on in their community. We saw so many police-involved shootings in the last 2 years. We saw HB2. We saw the body cam access being taken away. Yep. And all these issues that concerned, you know, your everyday citizens out here. And I didn't see that conversation reflected in mainstream media.
Well, let me ask you more about it, Bishop. Maybe I'll put the question to you. But yeah. But we did. You said we saw it, and we did see it. Yeah. So it was out there. What was missing in all of that coverage?
It was missing the conversation of people that talk like our generation.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, it's great when you can get your Walter Cronkite,
your Cornel West,
and it's like, you know, you're intellectual, but sometimes you just want to have that good old barbershop talk with somebody that can, you know, just get down to the meat and potatoes and would it make it easily digestible.
So I want to play a clip right here to give us an example, a clip where you're discussing, I think you're at Papa John's Pizza, right?
Yeah.
Papa John's is blaming lost sales on NFL players taking a knee.
Right.
So you got this big sponsor, and you had Durham artist Gemini and rapper Juice Lord Magnus, right?
Yeah.
As your guest. And here you are talking about Papa John's moaning about losing sales because of the NFL's protest.
Issue amongst its players. And
first of all, he still pays his employees minimum wage.
not even paying them like living wages. Like, right. Nobody cares what you say.
But, right. And the thing, too, is after the next day, after he said that, his stock dropped to like $60 a share, and he lost like $70 million in like a couple hours.
You know, that's what happens.
Damn.
You know what I'm saying?
I mean, he also negated the Trump campaign. We're not going to talk about that.
I feel like that was that's like one hand washing the other. I feel like that was like
sipping Caucasian tears.
Yeah.
Artist Gemini, rapper Juice Lord Magnus on the entertainment news show Intelligently Ratchet, and I'm here with the show's creators and hosts, Kevin Thomas and Kareem Jarrett, better known as Kazi and Bishop Omega. So where were you when you had that conversation?
We were on the couch in my living room.
Yeah.
That is part of the, I guess, the ratchet of it, you know, or just to say that, you know, it's that down to earth that we found out that the best conversations that we have amongst ourselves are when we're sitting down on the couch, we're somewhere smoking a cigarette. It's just like that,
right,
on that candid conversation that you have between two people where it's like the information that he has and I has come together, and we're having this general conversation with everybody on social media. We're having it live on Facebook with everyone to in real time.
Right.
Well, one of the interesting things about the hold it, sipping Caucasian tears, that thing?
Yeah.
Is that a phrase that I have missed? Because there's the well of my ignorance is deep, so I've not heard that one.
I mean, I don't know, Bishop.
The first time I heard that was that night. I was like, wow, let's put that on a t-shirt.
Yeah.
That's gonna be awesome.
Jim and I could tell you more about that.
But I mean, I could learn from that. But the other thing is, here's how we have the conversation. Now, here's what's interesting about that. You could say, well, all right, so I'm going to have this conversation about Papa John's losing sales and that complaint. And I say, well, on the one hand, you know, players shouldn't abdicate their rights to have a social conscience and express it on the field. On the other hand, you know, they're under contract and Papa John's makes a lot of money on the commercials. We could have that conversation.
Sure.
But what they're saying is, hey, this guy doesn't even pay his people minimum wage.
Right.
Like, so the well of social justice issues that are opened up go beyond what we might limit ourselves to on a talk show like this, where I want to know, do you have the right or don't you, and what are the limits of that conversation? Right. This is what people are actually thinking.
Yeah. Exactly.
What they're actually saying is, this guy cheats his own workers, and now he's telling me that I should not talk about injustice.
Right.
And then to take a issue like kneeling for the national anthem, and then to blame your sales on that, and to say because, you know, the commissioner of the NFL couldn't keep his boys in line, couldn't keep his players in line, and that was the reason it was affecting his sales.
And
it added a whole nother racial dynamic to it, if you ask me.
Exactly.
It was to say, like, and to take more away from what Colin Kaepernick was really trying to achieve and blaming that on his pizza sales. Those are the type of issues we call out.
Yeah, and it's like we kind of cut through the BS. It's like common sense, because it's some stuff is like nonsensical that the media will do to like a certain. Like kneeling, I understand the reason why he was kneeling as a black man in America. I totally understood. Okay, that's the reason why he's doing it. If they didn't say anything, or if they didn't blow it up and add this, and it's unpatriotic or anything like that. Like, no, he did it to say, hey, I want you to look
awareness,
or, and you know what I mean. And instead of people embracing it, they wanted to put a negative spin on it, and then they brought in, like, no, he doesn't respect the military. He said, I didn't talk about the military.
Yeah.
And then they don't listen. Once something gets in the media, everybody goes with that same trend.
And then it's
like, okay, let's back it up. That's the good thing about being an intelligently ratchet and us doing our own thing, because we can say, yo, now all this right here, let's not talk about that. We can go on this path.
Yeah. And if I could take it a step further,
then
you get commentary, and this is part of the reason why we have our show, because then you get commentary from a lot of talking heads about how we should feel about it without asking any of us how we really feel about it. I haven't seen a 21, a 25, a 30-year-old African-American male on any of these shows saying how it affects him or how he feels about it. But I've seen a lot of people, and like I said, don't get me wrong, it's just a lot of people that have PhDs that are making six figures talking about what's going on with a kid in Durham that's walking on Fayetteville Street.
But the question is now, what about the effects of this? Because we've talked about the siloization, right? I mean, everybody's, you know, looking for their own validation. So who's watching your program, and what effect will it have if, let's assume that the folks who are watching this are already with you on this kind of, they're having that conversation. They've had it four times already. What's the value of showing that to people who are already sold?
Well, I think what it's kind of like reconfirmation of, like, hey, it's kind of the same reason why you watch Wolf Blitzer. You know, you might be like, hey, I like Wolf because he got the same beard I do. Yeah. It's just a lovely gray beard. And you know what I mean?
And the outfits.
Yeah, and the outfits. It's, it's awesome. So, but I mean,
got soul.
It's just because you like to see someone who looks like you.
Trained in the same procedures.
You know,
right?
And you want to see somebody that looks like you do a good job at what you're doing, even though, hey, I want to talk that. I want to, like, you. We got fans to say, hey, man, I wish I could do that, which you guys do.
And yeah, and we're, and when else in our busy week with everybody working, got kids going to school, do we stop and have a conversation about this with each other?
Exactly.
Like, in real time. Like, you know, when we're talking about something that happened 2 days ago, and then we can all talk about that together, and then you could comment, and this person could comment, and at the end of our program, somebody could say, you know what, I never thought about it like that. Yeah. Or we can agree to disagree.
Right.
But we have that conversation.
But you're modeling that. You're modeling that conversation, saying this is okay to have in public, and it's okay to take home. Right. I want to take another clip here, because you also talked to Durham mayoral candidates on the show, I've got a clip here where, Bishop, you're talking with the current mayor now. He was a candidate at the time, Steve Shule.
Shout out to Steve.
Here we go.
As a long time, I've been in Durham since 1995, and I've been here when you couldn't do anything downtown but go buy crack and go to court. So that's all that happened. That, like, you know what I'm saying? So that was, it was like you go downtown, you buy crack, you get caught with the crack. And it was nothing. It was always like me in my 20s, it was like there was nothing to do in Durham. There was no.
And there was a huge stigma.
Well, Durham's violent, and then there's nothing to do. So what do you do in Durham? You get violent.
So Durham County has the highest wages in the state, any county of the state. We're top of the 100 counties. We have the best paying jobs. But 60% of the jobs in Durham are held by people that drive here from somebody else. Mm-hmm. They drive from Yanceyville. They drive from Johnston County.
Clip of Durham Mayor Steve Shule on the entertainment news show Intelligently Ratchet. I'm here with the show's host, Kevin Thomas, and Kareem Jarrett, better known as Kazi and Bishop Omega.
Yeah.
So tell us about that. I mean, that's an I had had him on the show, I'm not sure that I would have asked him that question.
That's the beauty of our show, is that we get to be as real as possible, and we tell people, they're like, can I say that? And we're like, this is the show, you can say that, you know. And we were, you know, and we're talking about the power of social media. We interviewed Steve Shule. We interviewed candidate Farad Ali. We talked to Representative Marsha Mori. We talked to Judge Carl, and all during election time. Yeah. And when you're talking about our demographic and them being probably the most marginalized, when people say that they don't matter because they don't engage in politics. And we had thousands of viewers come on live, and people say, I personally had never had a conversation with Steve Shule or Farad.
Right.
And we're helping people make their decision about who they're going to vote for and engaging them about, hey, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, they say in the new median average for a Durham citizen's like 35.
35, yeah.
Yeah, it's something like that.
People logging on for that stream in the mayoral contest.
So,
can I be on your show?
Yes.
So what would that be like?
You're on the show right now.
You're on there right now. Whether you know it or not, you look great, man. You look amazing.
Turtle, that's pretty cool.
Frank, I don't think you know how much street cred you have.
Frank got the
street. We told people we were coming on the State of Things, and that was a big deal. Like, our street cred went, oh, you going Frank Stott? No, y'all on the way. Like, that's really exciting, but we would love to have you on, man.
All right. Well, you can do it now. You can ask me a question.
Okay.
If this were the show, if I was on your couch right now, how would that go? What would be happening?
Bishop, what would you ask?
What would I ask Frank?
Yeah.
I would ask
the
Frank.
Wolf Blitzer lookalike.
My Wolf Blitzer lookalike friend. What would I ask?
Yeah.
No, we would talk. We would say, hey, where do you, when you want to know the views of African Americans, where do you get your information from?
Yeah. Yeah.
Where do you go?
That's a good question. And we ask ourselves that. And are we, you know, do we have a bench deep enough, and can we go? So we have actually have sources. Like, we have to say, wait a minute, how would this sound? Mm-hmm. And we talk to people in the community. They do tend to have academic credentials.
Okay.
So, we don't know anybody. We don't have people who are here, resident here, who can talk with us about that. And we feel, I mean, I will tell you, we feel it as a deficit. So if I get 5 points for knowing, you know, how weak we are in the way we represent even the way we frame.
Mm-hmm.
And when we say, man, this is weak because I think we've left out a point of view here that we just don't have.
And that's why I think we're trying to fill that gap in there. Yeah, I was doing TV news for a while. I was doing a morning show, My Carolina Today. with a shout out to Valonda Calloway, and I was doing the entertainment news for about 2 years. And when that came to an end, the options were, you know, try to do an anchor, be a weatherman, right. you know, some Jim Cantore, stand in the eye of the storm stuff, or like do traffic. You right. know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I was like, this isn't a margin. This isn't where I want to be. This is not going to allow us to talk to Frank Stassio. This ain't going to allow us to talk right. about HB2 and things like that. And now we were like, okay, let's set this up. But at the same time, Frank, not to make it like where it's just blackety black, black beat, you know, like, mm-hmm, nah, right. I want it to be where it's open access to the conversation, a lot of people feel uncomfortable around. We have a lot of white viewership. Shouts out to all my white brothers and sisters out there that watch the show that say that, you know, I watch to get an insight, but I don't feel comfortable commenting. Right. And we're like, nah, we right. need the comment. This is right. where we made this for the dialogue, to be inclusive.
Absolutely. The problem really is now with white liberals. I mean, that's the deal. We get, you know, you can understand what's happening on the white supremacist nationalist side. Mm-hmm. That's pretty well defined. It's white progressives who don't want to have the conversation because they don't want to screw up.
Right. Right?
They don't want to say something and then have you turn around and say, oh, man.
Right.
They don't want to HMM it.
Right. Well, because you get into this battle over moral high ground.
Yes. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Where right. it's like we're holier now about 8, 9, and 10, but 11, well, let's not push it.
Right.
You know? And that's what I think we saw even with the statues and everything that's been going on here. It was like, well, this is wrong. I saw Duke take theirs down in 24 hours.
Right.
I'm a UNC grad. Ours is still up. And these are the type of thing in Chapel Hill. We claim ourselves to be the most liberal mm-hmm. place on the planet. Yeah. But, you know, we got our guys still up. So it's like these type of conversations that we like to have.
Do you feel any need to sort of study the tenets of journalism? Do you bring any of that? I mean, should there be some sort of, from the old regime, some of that craft come forward? Or can you kind of leave that behind? Is that any part of what you do?
Well, as far as I have not gone to college for any journalism, you know. Yeah. But what I do know as a stand-up comedian and as a poet and everything up to that point is that people understand leadership. So it doesn't matter if you have, there wasn't a college when Aristophanes said whatever he said.
He was the great philosopher Aristophanes.
You know what I mean? Yeah, the great
famous philosopher.
Famous philosopher is well known in most circles.
That's right.
But no, but I mean, he just didn't, like, you know, you can't, you know, you, these are the people that we look at, you know, did this person, you know, so it's like people understand leadership. So when you come from a leadership background, you know, I'm an older brother. I've headed my own comedy shows and everything like that, and I've had people under me. So it's just like, not under me, but you know what I'm saying, that I had to delegate jobs too. And it's just like, I think that's what they want. That's what people want. They want to say, hey, listen, sometimes you don't want the educated answer. You want your uncle, your drunk uncle's answer. And that's, you know, and it's,
that's Bishop.
It feels better. You know what I'm saying?
Well, because drunk uncles vote.
Right.
And they're honest.
And they're honest.
And they're honest.
And you want that drunk uncle honesty.
Yeah. So I think we make a great team because outside of being friends, I guess I kind of anchor the situation. Yep. I got a little media background. I did the morning show. Mm-hmm. I was an intern at K97 for about a year as well. Yep. So I've done, you know, hip hop nation. I've done some things in media that, you know, trying to be like Frank Stassio, you know what I mean? But,
be like Frank.
Yeah, but I think it's that our rapport and that, like, okay, I might come with something factual, statistical, and then Bishop will tell you what my drunk uncle is.
Yeah, what's your drunk uncle? Aristophanes. You
are going to have to get a lot older to be like me, man. I'm just warning you. My guests, Durham personalities, Kazi and Bishop Omega, broadcast on the new episode of their Street Smart News show right here, Intelligently Ratchet. Mm-hmm. It'll be tonight on Facebook Live, and I guess we're going out now. Anyway, you can go to any of those places, including stateofthings.org, to find out all of this stuff and links. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks, man. Appreciate it.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things, produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Jennifer Brooklyn, Robert Kinlaw, Angelique Perrin, Amanda Magnus, and Robin Copley, who's our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.